podcasts are just a form of storytelling. And storytelling is the way that we connect as human beings. I think that that's how we build empathy. I think it's how we build relationships. And so it really comes back to the characters and the story and why are people listening to what the people on the podcast are trying to say.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I had a good conversation with Jenny Kaplan, who's founder and CEO of the Wonder Media Network, which creates original podcasts and helps others create podcasts that aim, as she says, to inspire action, promote equality and justice, and introduce empathy into politics, business, and culture. Jenny is a journalist who quit her job at Bloomberg News, where she covered global business and also developed and co-hosted Bloomberg's Material World podcast, to start Wonder Media Network with her friend Shira Adkins. Both were former Brown students. Jenny has a good story about how her mother's run for Congress fit into her decision to become a startup founder. The episode is well worth your listen. So after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Jenny Kaplan of Wonder Media Network.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm great. I'm very excited about this interview.
Cool. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Jenny Kaplan. I am the co-founder and CEO of Wonder Media Network. We are an audio-first media company focused on amplifying underrepresented voices, inspiring action, and introducing empathy into politics, business, and culture.
That's a pretty broad aspiration there, but pretty cool.
You know, aim high.
What is the Wonder Media Network?
So we create podcasts. Half of what we do is we create Wonder Media Network branded podcasts, and half of what we do is we produce podcasts for other organizations to help them with their either internally facing or externally facing communications needs and storytelling.
What is a podcast?
A podcast?
Well, I thought I would ask, even though you're on a podcast, because I'm not entirely clear. You might as well clear it up for me.
In a lot of ways, podcasting is just on-demand radio. So it's storytelling for your ears. I think podcasting is really incredible as a medium because it really creates a special relationship between the host and the listener. People want more and more nuanced podcasts. They want nuanced stories in this medium. Whereas in most other mediums, I think that people want shorter and shorter content that's less and less nuanced. So I think it's a really amazing way to tell stories that aren't otherwise being told or aren't being told well.
It's kind of nice to have something that's a longer form.
Totally.
Where did the idea come to you? Why did you think of this as a need out there?
So I was working as a reporter at Bloomberg News, and that's where I spent my career before this, when in December of 2017, my mom decided to run for Congress in North Carolina, which is where I'm from. I had always been obsessed with politics. It's not what I covered at Bloomberg, but I had always been very into it. But when I looked around, I couldn't really find stories of my mom or the people like my mom who had decided to run for Congress. I couldn't find their stories being told well the statistic of a record number of women running for office was everywhere, but the actual human stories of why so many women decided to leave their normal lives and run for office, which is a crazy thing to do, that wasn't really anywhere, the human stories. So I became obsessed. I also couldn't stop thinking about why there are so few women in office to begin with. And my whole life, I have believed that government would be better if it looked more like the people it represents. But I was fascinated by the idea of trying to find sort of proof of that, or to see if there was proof of that. I had actually started a podcast at Bloomberg. That's how I first got into audio. I was a regular print reporter, but I had started a podcast there. When I became obsessed with this issue and these stories, I decided to quit and start our first show, which was called Women Belong in the House. So I convinced my co-founder to join me, had simultaneously been pretty obsessed with some other stories, stories that I just felt like weren't being told very well, and we launched.
So because your mom ran, and because that's such a big part of the story, could you talk a little bit about what it was like to grow up in your family and what she was like politically?
Sure. I grew up in North Carolina, at Greensboro, North Carolina. My family was always quite politically active. We talked about politics around the dinner table. It was just always something that we were all very into. Also, I grew up around a lot of working on campaigns in a volunteer sense and going to a lot of political fundraisers and making calls and going door to door, all of that kind of stuff. Then went to college, studied international relations, and my senior year decided between going into politics more professionally and going into journalism. I'd also always wanted to be a journalist and decided it would be better for me to do journalism first and then decide if I wanted to go into politics rather than the other way around.
What had your mom done as a career prior to running?
She was an attorney. So she had been a litigator and then started an immigration law practice in Greensboro.
And if I recall correctly, she didn't win that race.
She did not win.
Yeah, my brother ran for office and for county commissioner. And I remember what it's like to be in a family when someone runs. It's a big deal. And you're kind of out there and you kind of vibrate to the ups and downs. What was it like for you to watch your mom step out like that?
It was really, really inspiring. I mean, I quit my job and started a new company, basically taking after her example of taking a big risk. And it was extremely intense. I mean, I was living in LA at the time that I quit and started this, and I moved back home for the last several months of the campaign because I was covering this and it felt right to be home and I wanted to be there. And so I really was there. There were a lot of parts of the campaign that I logically already knew about, I intellectually already knew about, but to experience them firsthand was pretty insane. Like to see ads on TV that were just totally incorrect. There were TV ads that the networks actually took down because they were so incorrect, pointed towards my mom. That was a really, really intense thing to go through.
She ran in the 13th district in North Carolina, right?
Yes, she did.
What's that district like? What were her chances, would you have said, going in?
The 13th district is a red district, but it contains Greensboro, which is where I'm from, and then also a lot of the surrounding rural area. By the end of the campaign, it was seen as a potential swing district. At the beginning of the campaign, it was seen as pretty solidly red.
So she made it a race.
She did.
A lot of people who run don't make it the first time, run again, and sometimes succeed. Is that something she might consider?
We'll see. People would love for her to. There was so much energy and enthusiasm all over, both from like her campaign staff, which everyone was, I feel like I saw enthusiasm that is out of the norm in terms of how much her the people working for her loved her. And also all over the district. So I think it would be great. And she would be an incredible congressperson. And also the districts in North Carolina have been deemed unfairly gerrymandered. So I think that in some ways it's sort of like, until that is changed, there's not a great chance there for anyone.
Yeah. You wrote an article about this for Glamour, right? Why did you decide to write about this experience?
I have to say, this is, I think, the only time in my life that I, despite being a writer by profession for many years, it was the only time in my life that I sort of woke up and felt like I had to write down what I was feeling at that moment. The night of the election, as you mentioned, my mom lost, and watching her, it was the most inspiring part of the whole ordeal, was watching her lose, actually. Just the way that she handled it, there was no like crying on her part. It was like absolute grace and energy in a really positive manner. It was just amazing. And so I woke up the next day, and just like before I could do anything else, before I went down and saw my whole family at breakfast, I just felt like I had to write it. And I was very, very immersed. I mean, at that point, last fall, I was working like 20-hour days trying to produce Women Belong in the House. So I was also quite tired. So for me to wake up and do anything else other than trying to produce the podcast first thing, I was just really, really energized and really felt like I had to get the story out.
Okay. So I have a sense of where you are post that election. How does that turn into Wonder Media Network?
From the beginning, we wanted to create this whole company.
You said you had a co-founder. Who's that? And
yes. So my co-founder's name is Shira Atkins. We know each other because we were very good friends in college.
At Brown, right?
At Brown, yes. I had convinced her when I wanted to start this show and this company, I had created a pretty, what would turn out to be a relatively incorrect business model and financial model, and have realized that I really thought this could be a viable business, and convinced her to join me. From the beginning, this had been not just one show. It was a whole company that we had a vision for. Women Belong in the House, we really wanted to do and create proof of concept and prove that we could produce a really, really awesome narrative style podcast that people would love. And we wanted to prove that people wanted more content like this. And we did. And so Women Belong in the House continued a few weeks after the election. I did an episode about my mom losing. I did an episode about more broadly what had happened, which was a much happier story. We had already started booking interviews and starting production on our second show, which was released a few months later, and our third show, which was around that same time.
For Women Belong in the House, how many episodes was that? Is that something that's ongoing, or it went for a certain number of episodes and then you retired it?
Women Belong in the House, it was something like 20 episodes in the end. We, halfway through the season, we started doing bonus episodes in addition to our regular weekly episodes. So the regular episodes were audio documentary style, where I wove a bunch of different interviews together. Those were released on Tuesdays. And then on Thursdays, we put out bonus episodes, which were lightly edited full interviews of different experts or people. We're in production for season two of Women Belong in the House. So it ended, and then it'll start back up.
And what were shows two and three that you referenced?
Our second podcast was called Web of Women, Web of WMN. And that was an interview style show where the concept was we wanted to sort of paint a picture of individual and community identities. So I picked four different people who I know from different parts of my life, four different women, and interviewed each of them. And we talked about politics and gender and religion and all sorts of different career, different things that make up our identities. And then each of those women picked a woman to interview from her network. So it sort of expanded like a web. So that was our second show. Our third show was called The Brown Girl's Guide to Politics. It was hosted by Ashanti Golar, who's the political director of Emerge America.
Who I've interviewed on this show.
Ashanti's the best. We love her. Yeah. And so she had been a very present guest during Women Belong in the House, and approached us after, and we decided to create this podcast together. So the Brown Girls Guide to Politics podcast was our third show to launch, and we're season two of that show is launching this week.
What constitutes success for you in launching these podcasts? It is a busy space right now, kind of like the world of blogs was some years ago. What are you looking to happen, and how close are you getting with these shows that you've put out there?
So to this point, we've put out 6 original Wonder Media Network shows, including our biggest one is called Encyclopedia Womanica. And then we've also put out almost the same number of white labeled shows. So shows that we've produced for other organizations. In some ways, the work itself is success because we're telling stories that we think need to be heard. The biggest challenge and opportunity is in audience growth. As you mentioned, there are a lot of podcasts out there. And so what we've worked really hard to do and what we've been able to do pretty successfully is to work with the different platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Stitcher and the many, many others, to work with them to try to make it easier for people to find our shows, whether that's being included on different homepage collections or in New and Noteworthy or whatever it might be. A sign of success is growth, and that looks different for different shows. Some of our shows are much bigger than others, and that I think will always be the case. The other thing is, you know, we're a business, so there are other signs of success in terms of making sure that we are making money and able to support creating more and more content that can amplify underrepresented voices and get these stories out there that otherwise wouldn't be there.
My guess would be, without knowing, that your money is in the white labeled shows at the moment and not in the ones you're putting out. Am I right?
Well, let me tell you, you are not the first person to guess that. And it's actually about 50-50. We have put a lot of focus and time on figuring out our revenue model on the Wonder Media Network original side, and we've had really good luck with that. So rather than the typical sales model with the podcasting industry, which is normally based on a certain dollar amount per 1,000 downloads, we've really focused on creating more beneficial relationships for our sponsors by offering exclusive season sponsorships where we create more highly produced ads, and it's sort of a broader partnership. And so we've been able to do that for a number of our shows in a way that has yielded really great results for us and also for the sponsor. So as an example, that first season of Web of Women was sponsored exclusively by Skype, which made a lot of sense because it was all about connections and community, and we were actually using Skype for a lot of the interviews. The first season of The Brown Girl's Guide to Politics was sponsored by ActBlue, which made a lot of sense for them and made a lot of sense for us. The second season is also sponsored by them. So another example, for Encyclopedia Womanica, it's a 5-minute daily show. Every episode is the story of a different woman from history who you may not know about but should. And every month is themed, and so we've been able to find sponsors that fit with the theme, where actually instead of just like a normal ad where the host is reading it and it may not sound particularly compelling, we produce mini episodes that are dropped in the actual feed. And we've seen really, really good returns on that because there's a better opportunity to more authentically tie the brand and their message to what listeners actually care about and why they're tuning into the show.
Where do you host these podcasts? Are they all in the same place? And how do you record them? What are sort of the basic tools you're using to put things together?
So we host our shows on Simplecast. I highly recommend Simplecast. All of this has evolved from launch to now. We haven't always used the same equipment or hosted on the same platforms or anything like that. There was a time not so long ago when really I just had like a couple of mics and we were taking them to all of our interviews. I had a Zoom recorder and either used that or plugged mics into my computer. For Women Belong in the House, I was recording and editing everything. Once I had spliced everything together, I sent it to an audio engineer to fix it. But largely, it was just me and my Blue Yeti mic and my computer. I was even using GarageBand for quite some time, which I would not recommend if you're doing a narrative style podcast, although it can be great for other things. since then, we now have, I'm sitting in our office in Manhattan. We have our own studio where we have a real setup and a soundboard and all of this kind of stuff. We have three producers on staff who handle most of the technical program stuff now. I'm luckily only cutting the tape for one of our shows full time. And otherwise, I'm more higher level editing. So all of our equipment has really evolved a lot since we were first starting. But yeah, there was a period where I was recording narration, like either in my closet or under my duvet cover. So it's good to have a real studio now.
Sounds like pretty exciting forward movement. Who's working for you right now? You mentioned some producers. How much of a team have you put together?
So there are 8 of us total right now, and we are hiring at the moment. I think we'll probably be up to about 12 by the end of the year. There are 5 of us who are more on the content side. So basically, I'm in charge of spearheading all of our content creation and development, in addition to doing all of the CEO type things that I have to do. Then Shira, my co-founder, is spearheading all of our sales and marketing, and we sort of split business development. Most of our people right now who we've hired are on the content side. We have 3 producers, like I said. One of those producers is our director of audio, so she is sort of the leader of that team. We have an editorial and community manager who helps me with content as well. On the business side, we have a marketing manager and a business development intern, and then Shira is hiring a few more people on that side. So we're growing on both sides of the business. I think right now our focus is on really growing the sales and marketing team, but we will always need more and more producers because that's how we create the content.
Have you raised money then to build this enterprise?
So we have raised a little bit of money. We got an investment from New Media Ventures, but that's the only money that we've raised. We've been bootstrapped throughout. We've very, very recently raised money from New Media Ventures. And so prior to that, we just have grown as we've grown our revenue. And really feel like we wanted to be extra, extra careful before we were taking money from anyone else to make sure that we had proven our revenue model. And also, we don't want to get into a situation where we feel like we're over-raising.
With New Media Ventures, aside from the award of some money, have they been helpful to you in other regards?
Totally. So really the biggest thing for us is we wanted to make sure that anyone who we're partnering with is mission aligned and is helpful in terms of boosting our network. There was a world in which we weren't going to raise any money at all. And the appetite for what we're doing and our ability to grow is huge. And so what we want to make sure that we're doing is not sort of being too tight on that at the expense of letting our business grow. So the benefit of New Media Ventures, the reason why we wanted to work with them, is because they are so mission-driven and mission-aligned. And their network is filled with people who we want to work with to create really great content and really awesome stories, and who feel like they're pretty natural partners. So that's been really helpful already in seeing so many different people who we are now in conversations about working with them on different projects as we head into 2020.
How do you decide what kind of shows to pick to build or to help other people with? What are kind of the parameters of what you're looking for?
Everything we're doing has to be mission aligned, as I said, in some way. So our mission's pretty broad. I said it at the top of the show, but we're really working to amplify underrepresented voices, and we're focused on the intersection of politics, business, and culture. So, you know, it has to at least pass that barrier.
That's a pretty wide range, though. So most of the shows you've mentioned seem focused on the participation of women in one form or another. Is that the first area that is exciting for you?
That's where we've centered most of our interest thus far, yes. Part of the reason why the mission is broad is because we don't think that that is the entirety of our work and are open to doing other shows, but that is certainly where our focus has started. The other sort of determining factor of how we choose shows is there's a difference between whether we're talking about a white labeled show or a Wonder Media Network original show. There are all sorts of different factors for original shows, whether it's an idea that evolved in-house or an idea that was sort of presented to us by a potential host or production partner or whoever it may be. Some of it is just like, do we think that this is an appealing show? What does the marketplace look like for shows like that? Does it exist? Who are the people involved? Who would the people be who we'd want to interview? Is there already a show like that that we're developing, or, you know, how does it complement the rest of our portfolio? Then they're also sort of partners. So if it's, whether it's going to be a white labeled show or a show that's got our logo on it, but we're working alongside partners, what do those partners bring to the table? Whether that is money that they're going to pay us to produce the show, or audience development, or partnership when it comes to marketing, or whatever it is. So it's sort of like, what is the mission? What's the story? Is it a compelling story? And what's the strategic significance for that project moving forward as we grow as a company?
There's a lot of options for people who are seeking to make podcasts right now. There's lots of consultants, there's other networks, there's other producers. Why would someone want to choose to work with Wonder Media Network?
There are a lot of options out there, certainly. Some of that comes down to what the goals are of the group or person or people who are trying to make the show. So I feel like I'm saying this perhaps too much, but the fact that we have such a strong adherence to a mission is really attractive to a lot of the clients who we've worked with and a lot of the hosts who have come to us wanting to create shows. There are a lot of podcasts out there, and there are way, way too few podcasts that center on the stories of women and underrepresented voices. So despite the fact that there are so many shows that exist and so many different opportunities and ways to produce them, that's actually rarer than most people would like. Our mission is one reason. I also think that we have a track record of really great storytelling, and we're a nimble team dedicated to making sure that we listen to the goals and the sort of mission given to us by the people who we're working with.
Jenny, what makes a great podcast?
I mean, it really all comes down to the story. Podcasts are just a form of storytelling. And storytelling is the way that we connect as human beings. I think that that's how we build empathy. I think it's how we build relationships. And so it really comes back to the characters and the story and why are people listening to what the people on the podcast are trying to say.
You said these are narrative style. What does that mean?
So when I say narrative style, I mean there are a number of different interviews woven together as one story. So Planet Money or Radiolab, those are narrative style shows where there's sort of a narrator who's walking you through and driving the story rather than an interview style show or a talk show style show where it's one interview per episode.
Do you do any of the one interview per episode, or you stick to something that's more produced and planned out like that?
We do everything. So the Brown Girls Guide to Politics is a good example of an interview style show. We also have a show called For Future Reference. It's about mentorship. That's an interview style show. There are two
interviews. It's a nice title.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. So there are two interviews per episode, but it's still an interview style show. We have a nice mix of both.
How's the business doing as a business?
The business is great. We've been just really accelerating basically since launch, but particularly over the course of 2019, we continue to grow. So that's exciting and also always a little scary.
Does anyone ever come to you with a podcast that's already been out there for a while and say, how do I make this better?
Yes. So we've had that happen with both shows that are Wonder Media Network originals, and also with other sort of white label clients. So as an example, there's a show called The 43%, which is now a Wonder Media Network show for season two. For season one, it was produced by another awesome production company. We're friendly with that production company. When she didn't have bandwidth to take on season two, she passed The 43% onto us for season two, and now we have produced that. So that's an example of sort of like an existing show. And we've had some other existing shows approach us to talk about whether it would be possible to sort of join our network and improve lots of different things or get our sense of how to improve different things. And then on the white labeled side, we've also had big companies approach us to ask for help in terms of coaching of the host or audio feedback or whatever it might be to try to make the show better.
One of the aspects of some podcasts that sets them apart is sort of sound design. Or is that something that you work on? How do you assist in that?
Yes. So all the podcasts we produce, we score and think about different archival clips and do a lot of different work on sort of the soundscape. So, and the sonic brand, as Shira likes to say. So that totally depends. For an interview style show, that might be, okay, cool. What does the intro and outro music sound like? What does the ad music sound like? Do we want to have musical transitions throughout? What might those be? For a narrative style show, an audio documentary, that's much more involved and in depth. So how do we transition in and out of different clips? How do we want to use archival audio to supplement the show? I feel like it's sort of like ear candy. Like everyone loves hearing an archival clip that they either recognize or they can recognize the time period or whatever it is. So how do we balance all that stuff and make it a really as compelling a piece of content as possible? So that's certainly something that we work on for all of our shows.
I would assume that one of the key things that distinguishes different networks is the assistance that they might provide in finding an audience, because that's just so difficult often. So could you give me the example, say taking the first one that you did about women belonging in the house, how did you get that out there? How do you continue to promote it? What are the learnings that you have so far in how to do that?
It's really the biggest challenge in this industry is audience acquisition and discoverability. So we worked really, really hard to create contacts, to find contacts at all of the different listening platforms, because that's still the best way to get people to listen, is to try to get your show a little bit more visible on there. So we did that. And while we were doing that, we also, the other big tool I think that we have found really helpful is basically creating cross-promotional swaps with other podcasts that might have a similar or adjacent audience. So we did a lot of that for Women Belong in the House. And I think, you know, it doesn't always work that way, but we tried to send it out to everyone we could possibly think of, everyone we knew. And because it was so topical and because people were so passionate about the stories that were being told, that Women Belong in the House grew much more rapidly than I think many first-time shows grow without a network. So now we also benefit from the fact that we already have a network of listeners with whom we've established a relationship of trust. And so we can drop our new shows on the feeds of our old shows and can sort of get a head start with growing audience that way. But that is something that, you know, is more of a network effect and is another reason why people like to work with us or with other networks as opposed to starting off as sort of a lone wolf.
Can you give me a sense of the range of listeners per episode among the shows that you have? Does it range from 100 to a million, or what are you seeing in terms of episodes, and then how does that change over time?
Yeah, it changes enormously over time, which is a good thing. That's what we want to happen. It totally varies. So it's hard to really give you an accurate range, especially in our biggest shows are growing and changing so quickly that I don't want to give you a wrong number. We are definitely not in the millions per episode range yet, but hopefully sometime soon. But it's kind of interesting to see. We're doing right now our first survey to figure out exactly who is listening because the analytics and podcasting are so bad.
What do you use for the analytics? Is that something provided by Simplecast or do you use other overlays to measure this kind of thing?
So luckily, Simplecast brings in all of the analytics from all the different platforms. So we can also go and look at Apple or Spotify or, you know, any of the different platforms to get a sense of what our listenership is. It's all aggregated in Simplecast, and we can get things like, you know, where people are listening and how they're listening and when they're listening and all that kind of stuff. But we can't really get any demographic data. The only way to really do that is through surveys, which is the same thing that all of the biggest players are doing. And we are just doing our first survey of our own right now, which is very exciting.
Do you try to develop an email list of listeners? Podcasting is such a strange medium where you're kind of at arm's length from your listeners because of a feed that gets out there and you don't necessarily, unless you host it yourself very directly, you don't really know who's listening. How do you deal with that?
Part of that is exactly why we're now doing a survey to know that better. We do have a newsletter and we have had an email list since launch. And so we connect that way. We have emails associated with all of our shows to make sure that there are paths for listeners to get in touch with us. We have Facebook groups. We have all sorts of different stuff to try to keep in touch with our listeners and social media beyond Facebook. So all of that is helpful. And there are all sorts of new apps and programs out there that are trying to connect the community that is built through podcasting with the podcast creators. So we are also analyzing all of those to try to understand what the best path towards building community is, whether that's on established social media, whether it's on one of these new apps, whether it's through a membership kind of a program or live events or what that might be. But it definitely is an interesting opportunity to figure out how to take the close relationships that we have with listeners and make them more interactive.
You may know that one of the things that I've really focused on in this show is kind of the notion of political entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship, people who have tried to build companies in the space of politics, which is kind of an odd market in certain ways. What have you learned about entrepreneurship in the progressive political space?
It's a really exciting space to be in right now. I think there are a lot of challenges and there's huge opportunity for us to tell better stories. So I think that's really where we intersect with a lot of the other organizations who you might have on this show is how are progressive organizations talking about what they're doing? How are they activating voters or whoever their constituents might be? And how could that be better? How might that be better when it comes to other competitors and what they're doing? It's a really exciting space to be in. I think, like, especially now, everything's gearing up for 2020 or sort of already geared up for 2020. You know, there will be a lot to learn over the next year. And it seems like there's a big opportunity for organizations to start working together and a big possibility that they may fail to do so, which would be a shame.
I think a lot about a messaging war between the right and the left in this country and the sort of battlefield of organizations on one side and the other. And it's obviously complicated and some people are not arrayed in that way. But I wonder how you fit yourself into that competition that's out there.
So from the beginning, from launch, we have been a nonpartisan organization. We have always put ourselves in the framework that we are pro-women. I think that, unfortunately, that in some ways is a very partisan stance. And our mission is to amplify underrepresented voices, which also can feel quite partisan. But I don't think it should be. You know, we're going to take stances and action on specific issues as we see fit. But we have not specifically tied ourselves to a political party. That's sort of been how we have positioned ourselves. I don't know if that will stay the same or change, but that's really where we've found that we're most comfortable and that's the space that we want to occupy.
You spent about 4 years as a reporter for Bloomberg, is that right?
I did.
What did you learn in that that's been helpful in doing what you're doing now?
It was the best training I could have asked for in terms of reporting, in terms of storytelling. That whole experience taught me a lot in terms of trying to think about the pros and cons of being partisan or nonpartisan. Really, all of the tools and skills that I've learned from a technical perspective and from a journalism perspective were really honed there. So I feel like I learned a lot. And also from a business perspective, Bloomberg is such a great example of a media business that has a lot of diverse revenue streams. It's not even really a media business, it's a data business. And I think that that's come into handy in thinking about how do we want to set up this business? How do we want to make sure that we're not just reliant on sponsors, we're not just reliant on white labeled projects, but we have a lot of different sort of irons in the fire at one time.
Do you do any writing alongside the audio? It seems like an obvious addition to any podcast is something that people could consume that's more written.
I think that we increasingly will be writing stuff alongside the podcast. We decided to call ourselves an audio first media company for a reason. For now, we've stayed really, really focused. A lot of the podcasts themselves are very writing intensive, especially the narrative style ones that we were talking about. So I certainly get to write all the time still, but we haven't done so much ancillary content thus far. But we definitely will be moving forward.
Is there a question that I've failed to ask that you wish I had?
I don't think so. I feel like this has been quite thorough.
People often say that. I'm not sure that's high praise either, but I'm always very curious about things. And I do, I guess, ask a fair number of questions.
Well, why did you decide to create a podcast?
Well, I wanted to learn about what people were doing. And it seemed like a good method for getting them to talk to me is really what happened. And some 370 plus episodes in, I think I've learned a thing or two, and I've hopefully shared that with others. What's really surprising to me, I guess, is that I maintain a curiosity and an interest. Each time I have a new interview, I'm like all excited about it and excited to share it. So
that's awesome. So far, so good.
Yeah. And you're right in that. To me, hearing someone like you who stepped out of the regular kind of career path that you're on to create something that was exciting to her, to build a team that wants to do that together, to further the missions of aligned enterprises and to create things that are exciting. To me, that is like creating an awesome job for yourself. Well, Jenny, it's been an honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
I don't think so. Check out Encyclopedia Womanica. great chatting with you.
Check out all of the wonder. If people want to see a list of your shows and find them, how do they quickly do that?
They can go to wondermedianetwork.com, or they can in whatever platform they choose to listen to podcasts on, they can just search Wonder Media Network and our shows will come up.
Sounds good. That was Jenny Kaplan of Wonder Media Network. They're at wondermedianetwork.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistance-dashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.